The poet Anna Rabinowitz can't stop thinking about memory and forgetting. In fact, she considers it her moral imperative as a writer to remember the names and words of family and friends killed in the Holocaust, people who would otherwise be forgotten. Rabinowitz's book-length poem, Darkling, includes fragments of their voices. Now her poem has been turned into an opera, also called Darkling, which is just out on CD. She told Anne Strangechamps that the poem grew out of a cache of old letters and photos.
It was a shoebox, actually. It was the contents of a shoebox that I found in my father's closet after he died. And the contents included letters that had been written during the war years and before by members of the family and a few friends, and also photographs of many members of the family. The letters, of course, I could not read, I couldn't decipher, even if I knew Yiddish well enough, because they were written in this tiny, small hand. And I found somebody to translate the letters, and I proceeded for the next several years to be haunted by all that material, and felt that it was my duty, and particularly as a poet, I had no excuse. I needed to do something with all this material, because they were all dead. All these people had been murdered in the Holocaust, and there was nothing left of them but these scraps of information.
Did you know any of these people, these relatives? Had you grown up knowing any of their stories?
No, I had not known any of them. None of them had ever come to the United States.
Did it surprise you that you hadn't even heard any of these stories?
Well, yes, it did, but it also made me rather angry as a child because, children don't understand what their parents may or may not be going through, and I didn't realize until I was much older that it was far too painful for them to speak about all these close relatives, people they adored, who had been murdered, and they were the only survivors. There were really no cousins, no aunts, no grandparents. There was nobody at all. I think my parents were suffering tremendously. And once the Nazis came into Poland, that was close to the end of communication. There was hardly anything that came through.
This is making me think of one of my favorite, but also one of the most heartbreaking sections in the poem for me, is there these, you said that the letters are often fragmentary, but there's a section where you quote just fragments, phrases from mm-hmm. many different letters, and over again they say, remember me, remember us.
Yes, yes. Well, that's actually even more, I would say, an homage to the photographs, because that's what's on the photographs. And they didn't sign their names. They just wrote these little notes begging to be remembered. It was so upsetting, and they were yearning so much to be present. I felt that I had to do something.
This one, endlessly fixed on possibility.
A single ringlet at her brow.
Zum ewigen Andenken.
Ostrolenka, 1980.
Remember me forever.
And this one, no more than 20, perched on a ladder in an orchard, pretending to pick apples.
I give you my photo. Remember me.
Now in taffeta, turning toward the view, woods that were
or may have been.
Life is a battle, so fight to win.
My photo in remembrance
for the cousin I love.
1922.
And another.
Our friend, we give you this photo.
Remember us forever.
Warszawa, 1932.
Remember me.
Remember, I wished you the best.
From me, Yitzchak.
From me, Helena.
Regina.
Franek.
From me.
And me.
Ostrolenka, 1936.
And me.
One of the wonderful things about hearing Darkling, the opera, is it's so wonderful to hear all those different voices, which sometimes mm-hmm. are practically layered on top of each other. Is that how you heard the poem originally in your head?
Yes. I was writing this book for a multitude of voices, and they were begging to be heard, remember me forever. They were in my ears all the time.
Were there times when you felt like a medium or a channel?
Oh, I certainly did, very much so. Especially when I decided that since I was very interested in forms and I had been working with acrostics, that the feeling I had an affinity to the Darkling Thrush, Thomas Hardy's poem. I felt that he and I had something in common since he was looking back at the 19th century, which he thought was a fairly heinous century. And I was looking back at the 20th century, which could beat the 19th century by many miles. So I said to myself, well, maybe I want to take the armature of this poem. And I had also done a little research about acrostics, and it seems that in the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance, the acrostic was thought to be useful not only as a mnemonic device, but also as a way to generate meaning. And here I am working with so little material that the poem really spoke to me, his poem, and that we were in the same place and that the acrostic might somehow or other be my vehicle, my armature.
So this is such a fascinating thing that you did, especially considering that the poem began with kind of a box of family secrets. And it's as though you wrote a kind of secret code into the poem, too, in the form of this acrostic. And we should explain, so what is an acrostic?
An acrostic spells something out. If you look down the left-hand margin of every page, in this case, you will be reading from first line to last line, you will be reading Thomas Hardy's poem, The Darkling Thrush.
Can you recite any of The Darkling Thrush?
Well, it starts out, I lean upon a coppice gate. And that was another affinity that I felt my darkling had, or I had with Hardy, because looking through a coppice is a gnarled area where there are lots of trees growing very, very close together, and they cut them back and try to generate new growth. So it's a really gnarled, difficult place to navigate. So what could be more true? I was looking over a coppice gate just as Hardy was looking over a coppice gate. And it starts out, I leaned upon a coppice gate when frost was specter gray and winter's dregs made desolate the weakening eye of day. The tangled vine stems scored the sky like strings of broken lyres, and all mankind that haunted nigh had sought their household fires. And then the beauty of this poem is at the end, the darkling thrush appears, and this is a weary, skinny little, not very healthy-looking bird. But he sings out with this beautiful goodnight song, and Hardy says, his happy goodnight air, some blessed hope whereof he knew and I was unaware. And that couldn't have echoed my own feelings more.
In what sense? Because you're writing a poem about people who all perished in the Holocaust, and you've layered their voices.
Right.
There's such grief and such a sense of mourning.
Yes, exactly. But they're here. They're alive for a moment. They're being celebrated. Even the broken and destroyed earth needs to be celebrated. Even destroyed life needs to be remembered and honored and valorized, because what is most important is our lives. That's our gift, our lives.
Inside, the story. Inventories, incidents, pleading to be flossed from the teeth of silence. Leaching congealed vowels, lately of
longing for words.
This is this, that is that. As in first enunciations, as in debuts for old roles, as if to atone. Yes, I love you.
And your poem, names, Darkling, boarding, yes, it's about the people whose lives you're trying to kind of rescue from the abyss a little bit, but it also strikes me just as much about grief and about memory and about the way memory works. Am I right?
Absolutely. The thing about memory and history is that there's the inevitable distance that time imposes upon it. There's nothing we can do about it, but little by little, time is going to make it recede and recede and recede. And we, the living, need to navigate that distance as best we can. And for me, navigating that distance without trivializing it and without sentimentalizing it and also without commenting on it. I tried hard not to do that. I didn't want it to be centered on the anecdotal. I wanted it to be more centered on emotion and feeling.
I guess one of the questions about the Holocaust is, how do you mourn something that's almost too big to comprehend? You know, this is a grief that kind of echoes down through the generations. And what I hear you saying is that to a certain extent, every generation has to figure out their own form of mourning.
Exactly. I think that the mourning ultimately, in many cases, it becomes a very ritualistic mourning, and it becomes largely devoid of its emotional content. That's something that, in a way, you have to struggle against.
So is this a new place you're wanting to take poetry and opera, perhaps?
I think it would be absolutely extraordinary if more poetry could come off the page. Poetry in its own way is stultified. Most poets today speak to one another. They don't get out to a larger audience. I think it's a very, very sad development in our culture. The problem really is that too many poets don't care about that. They're perfectly happy to speak to each other, to teach in their writing programs, and they're not sufficiently engaged with the larger world. And I think theater, opera, is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful way, obviously, to engage with the larger world. So there you have the problem with poets. They're too conservative and too inbred. And I think there's a similar problem in the world of opera. The opera companies are afraid of trying something new. They're worried about their audiences. They have to sell tickets. Maybe they won't sell out the house. I mean, these are all their concerns. And I'm convinced that if they took the risk, they might be very pleasantly surprised.
So little cause and illusions of meaning withdraw. Oh, little cause of time torn, torn time, motes in time. Little can they know trapped in that time, in that abyss of history, when word claws tear at their throats.
Little causes, skull caps, sideburns, leaning cottages on chicken legs.
If we forget, lest we forget, lest we forget.
Oh, scattered sheep, exiled to lost roads, nuggets of piety cling to their coats, on their brows they glow.
Oh, guardian light,
oh, guardian
on the floor a child writhes,
a child
the Rebbe's in the stove,
the Rebbe's
slumber,
in the stove.
Landslide doze, long live this drone.
Long live this drone. This winter dark of dregs.
An excerpt from the opera Darkling, which has just been released on CD. It's based on the poem of the same name by Anna Rabinowitz. Anne Strangechamp spoke with her.